that specifically. So I think one is the national rhetoric, and the second thing is what is happening at the border is not necessarily reflecting that rhetoric.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Fernando Garcia, founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights in El Paso. He met with Vice President Harris when she went to the border on Friday. That does it for our show. A happy belated birthday to John Randolph. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tierra Sena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Andriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of
our lungs. KBOO Community Radio Facebook page. Find KBOO Community Radio on Facebook and like our page and have events, ticket giveaways, and great information delivered directly to your personal feed. One out of every seven humans is on Facebook, so using Facebook to share KBOO with your friends and family has never been easier. Like KBOO on Facebook today.
Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/soul2021 to listen to the archive show. You can also snag a limited edition soul and hip hop t-shirt before July 7th to show your support for the music and programming you love. Again, you can catch the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon and snag a limited edition t-shirt at kboo.fm/soul2021.
Bearing Witness, part of the Racial Reckoning Project, is a reflective dive into the week's events unfolding in this season of racial upheaval and, we hope, change. I'm Anthony Galloway, Executive Director of the Arts Us Center for the African Diaspora.
And I'm Georgia Fort, an independent journalist.
Georgia, you were in the courtroom, one of only two, I believe, pool reporters at the centerpiece of this sentencing. So fill us in.
Yeah, it was a very intense afternoon, and there were a few things that surprised me. I was a bit surprised to see Derek Chauvin's parents, at least it was his mother and potentially his stepfather, in the courtroom along with his ex-wife and her two sons. And then, of course, Floyd's family was there, and we were uncertain whether or not Chauvin was actually going to step up to the microphone and say anything. I'm sure his attorney encouraged him to do it, to offer some type of remorse to the family so that the judge could take that into consideration before issuing the sentence. And, you know, it was a little weird. We heard Chauvin offer his condolences. And then there was this other remark that a lot of people are trying to decipher where he said, he couldn't say much because of legal matters, which potentially is tied to the federal investigation that's ongoing.
I do want to give my condolences to the Floyd family. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest. And I hope things will give you some peace of mind.
And so I don't know if that's the sentencing information or other information in the trial. So that, I think, caught a lot of people off guard.
It was very perplexing. I was listening to it surrounded by a group of young people. And when they got to that part, they all their faces scrunched up as well. As well as you know, some feelings of wondering, what does 22 and a half years, which was the sentence ultimately that was delivered, what does that mean in the context of what could have been? We know that the state was asking for 30, I believe, and the minimum or the maximum without aggravating factors was somewhere around 20. And he got 22 and a half. And so I'm hearing a lot of messages of it's not justice. Even Attorney General Ellison said, you know, it's not justice, but it's accountability. You know, what are you hearing from folks since you were there?
Well, I am hearing that folks outside of the courthouse were pretty disappointed that it wasn't a stiffer sentence. There's other people who are glad that, you know, he got more time than Mohammed Noor, who was convicted for the death of Justine Damon. And so, yeah, I think people just have mixed emotions. And clearly, at the end of the day, we've heard from the family that true justice would be George Floyd still being here. And so any measure of man-made constructed justice is never going to fill that void.
You know, I was shocked again to listen to George Floyd's daughter because there were four community input testimonies that happened. And while hearing from George Floyd's siblings definitely was a thing, hearing his daughter just about broke me. And I hearing that, I definitely expected for there to be a stiffer sentence. But I also heard that there was a call to and some really, really strong efforts to get the sentencing just right on the part of both the judge and communities. Can you what has that been like seeing folks try to really dial in at the sweet spot of this?
Well, I think the other moment during sentencing that was very emotional. And I could see this going a lot of different ways, people expressing their frustration and other people who have different values and beliefs really feeling like their voice was represented when Chauvin's mother stood up and gave her statement. And I thought it was interesting that she centered so much of his career in her statement and said that there were two moments in her life that were, you know, her happiest. It was the day he was born, and it was the day that she pinned his police badge on him. And it was interesting to hear her center that message, knowing even that defense attorney Nelson had talked about the cultural implications, the political implications, the racial divide, all of these different things that he said they tried to weed out, but ultimately still were at the center of this trial. And we know that they, even in jury selection, were asking people about their affiliations to either Black Lives Matter or the Thin Blue Line. And so for her to point to that moment of pinning his police badge on him as one of her happiest moments, it felt like to some degree she was expressing her allegiance and somewhat of a dog. It felt a little bit like a dog whistle.
You know, if you had made mention earlier, you know, in our recordings around the minimization that's happening, and it definitely felt minimizing to what had been done. I thought there would have been much more remorse. I've been in a situation of watching family members and friends who had been sentenced, you know, speak on their own behalf and try to show some kind of remorse for the victim when it has happened in order to try to have that be a part of the sentencing. Now, I don't know what he wrote to the judge, but I didn't get a sense of any of that. That maneuvering, which makes me think that their attention is focused directly on trying to appeal.
I could see that. And I think the fact that he only offered his condolences and did not take the opportunity to express any accountability for his actions is a clear indication that he's absolutely going to try to appeal.
Georgia, thank you so much for that recap. We'll head back to our previously recorded Bearing Witness podcast episode. Georgia, we know you'll keep us continue to keep us posted. Thank you for your work, especially if you want to find out more. Make sure you go to racialreckoningmn.org.
You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Imprisonment is increasingly used as a strategy of deflection of the underlying social problems, racism, poverty, unemployment, lack of education, and so on. Angela Davis, freedom is a constant struggle. As we look through this week, we have many of the battles and struggles that we see on many different levels actually moving towards our policy battles. Now, we've been talking about this coming space for a while, and now we are in a space where we see not just policy fights happening, but some of the wraparound issues that are coming up for us on this journey on many levels. We have the sentencing of Derek Chauvin, of course. We have the other trials that are coming on online. We have the restrictions to voting rights that are now happening. As we've talked about this battle back and forth of what's going to be the response to a season that seemed like it was pushing towards greater levels of consciousness, understanding, we are now seeing the fault lines and the predictable patterns of resistance to this kind of change in discourse, even all the way to legislative action telling us what we can and cannot teach our children. There's a lot going on in this space. So Ms. Georgia, I'm curious, as you think through this week and the activities that are happening around us, what have you been seeing in this nexus as we are in this arc of racial justice?
I have continued to see this through line, the interconnectedness of so many different issues, from the pushback for voting rights. We saw Republicans actually vote against an act that would allow for voting to be easier. Just that simple. We also saw a lot of individuals across the country come forward and say that critical race theory should not be taught in schools. And simultaneously, one of our own treasures, one of our own gems here in the Twin Cities, he is a New York Times bestselling author, Rezma Menekin, participated in a 5-part series on race with the Washington Post. It also centered voices of other scholars. And that series was ripped to shreds. You had people on Fox News, Ben Shapiro, who really line by line went through and tore apart everything that that project stood for. And in watching all of this play out, you know, just kind of scrolling on my timeline and seeing that these national figures are not only attacking other scholars, but attacking one of our own here, who is known in our community as a healer, as someone who helps process trauma, who builds awareness about historical trauma, and to be painted out as such a negative figure. And then I think also what disappointed me was the Washington Post has yet to really respond to all of these different accusations about this project. And they're the one who commissioned it. And just for clarity, if you're not familiar with this 5-part series, it's called The New Normal, and it's inclusive. So, I mean, you have white people who are talking about race and their experience and understanding their own privilege and their own white identity. And then you have Asian and indigenous experts who are at the table. So it's a very inclusive conversation. And I think it's the type of conversation that we should be having when we talk about where we are in this post-pandemic society, where we are in this post-George Floyd world, where are we and how much progress have we really made. And if we're going to attack people coming together to have a formalized conversation around race, and in the same breath also attack critical race theory, and in the same breath also attack people like Brother Kaepernick, and also attack the people who went out and just protested. Where I'm at this week, Anthony, is asking myself, if we're really going to have a racial reckoning, how are we going to have a racial reckoning when every avenue to push forth change for a more equitable nation is met with so much resistance?
And it's the resistance and is patterned. And we've talked about this, right? Like it's not the tropes and the talking points centered around that are not new. They keep coming up every time there is a challenging of our quote unquote American mythos. And this is the thing that gets difficult, because we've established already that there are healthy critiques in our communities of all of our political parties and all of these policies and decisions that have happened. We owe a lot of mass incarcerative language to Democratic policy. We also owe a lot of the delay on enshrining and protecting the rights of marginalized communities on tactics that were used by these predictable patterns of resistance. When anti-lynching laws were being brought forward, the filibuster was used to stall and eliminate them. And these were laws that would have protected people and brought in federal oversight in a way to stop people from being murdered and massacred. We see that in response to the opening of rights to even women voting, we saw predictable patterns of resistance that said, why are we changing who we are? And why are we, trying to make this nation seem like we're bad in the face of enshrining the right to vote to everybody? And so these resistance and predictable patterns were around for suffrage movement. They were there. They've been around for civil rights movement. They're being now done around here, around the protection of voting rights and even to address full and true histories. You're listening to Bearing Witness with Anthony and Georgia, with special guest Monique Linder, created and supported by AMPERS, KMOJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit racialreckoningmn.org. I took my family on a trip down south, and it just so happened to coincide with the men of Ujamaa Place, under the leadership of Monique Linder, in this trip. We're on a civil rights research experience. Now, me and Ms. Linder have been on this experience with youth several years. And we met up at the lynching memorial and got to hear from one of the lawyers under Brian Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative. And there were some fascinating pieces of learning. And so I'm really excited to bring in Monique Linder, who is no stranger to media herself. And she can tell you all kinds of stories. But Ms. Linder, I'm curious to your reactions to the conversation that you just heard me and Ms. Georgia have.
Wow. First, I want to thank you for bringing me on Bearing Witness. The conversation was just incredible, so deep, impactful, a great conversation. I'm excited to have that talk based on what you and I have experienced together through this civil rights research discovery. But, just want to acknowledge Georgia Fort, because in the past year, what you have brought forth in the conversations around race, equality, justice has been so important to our community, which I call this ground zero in terms of the fight that's ahead of us. We're still fighting on the ground, but the bigger fight is ahead of us, and I'm looking forward and digging into that with you today.
I appreciate that so very much, and I'm really excited to hear more about the trip and the experience you two had. I think a lot about how allies can support and help advance solutions, how allies can use their social capital and their influence. I was having a conversation with somewhat of a colleague, and she was taken aback by, especially when you start talking about media and the role that media plays in perpetuating systematic racism and upholding some of these narratives. And, you know, she's like, well, you just need an extra set of eyes. They're like, no, actually, the thing about narrative is a lot of times narrative gets twisted by people who have implicit bias, right? Or claim to be ignorant. And I feel like there's so many folks who are racist that are hiding behind this veil. And I was like trying to articulate to her the way that I was seeing this play out and perpetuate in so many newsrooms. And finally, I just asked her, I said, have you ever met a person who's racist, like who just came out and said, yeah, I'm racist? How many people do you know who just come out and say that they're a racist?
Well, not too many people will admit that they are racist, right?
My name is Karen. I'm racist. I mean, you don't meet people who claim to be racist. You learn to understand they're racist based on their behaviors.
And you do your best to educate them, but at some point you just have to, just like I said, you have to stay focused. Trying to educate a person who does not believe that they're a racist, to try to, you know, to all you can do with that person is educate them on facts. And so it's such an important conversation they have to have. But you can recognize, if you're in a room, you can feel the energy from people who are racist and who may not have your best interests. And I've heard Rosma Mannequin say many times, survey the room when you walk into the room. Because that's the first thing you need to know is, and feel that energy and feel it. And sometimes it might take leaving the room, getting out of that space, because it's not, you don't want to take in all of that negative energy.
There's an important distinction that you all are bringing forward here, because, you know, in critical racial discourse, right, one of the things that happens as a predictable pattern in that discourse is it gets pulled into a conversation about what is in somebody's heart. I'm sorry, we didn't march and die and bleed to not be called out our names. We can handle that. We're big kids, right? That's not what people are. It is the systemic pieces that don't require intention or malice. This is one of the hardest things to swallow when you start to understand how systemic racist behavior works. I know for me as a Black male, the moment that conversation gets pulled into that pantheon, then all of the points in the work that I'm trying to bring onto the table immediately become irrelevant to that conversation, because I don't care about what's in your heart. I care about the behaviors. I care about the data. I care about the patterns. I care about the systemic spaces. It'd be great to know that you don't like me or you were scared of me because of the color of my skin, but that takes relationship, and we don't always have the luxury of that. There are tenets of critical race theory that critique liberalism, that critique the folks who show up and say the quote unquote right words, but their behavior and policy and actions below that surface tell a very different story. I hear the conversation, and even when we were in Montgomery, what blew my mind, we didn't get into a conversation about what was in people's hearts. The lawyers that you had speak to the group, which I thought were fascinating and did a great job, they were telling us stories about real policy, real practice, right? It blew my mind. And in that process, there are so many people on death row who can't even afford a proper defense. And then we wonder why so many people are executed. And then we find out years later that they had nothing to do with the crime. So Ms. Linder, you brought that information to a lot of us. And I'm just curious about some of the patterns that you did that in during that trip that you were able to pull out to kind of suss out the systemic nature of what we're talking about.
That, wow, that was it. That part of the trip, and I can tell you that when we went a year or 2 years ago before the pandemic, mm-hmm. we had students. There was such a different dynamic having men out of the criminal justice system on this trip. So you had Ujamaa men, and I'll tell you the first experience. So when we arrived in Montgomery, the first day, we just did some museum tours. But when we went to Selma, I can't even tell you the impact that that experience, the Middle Passage and the Willie Lynch experience had on these men. Think of men who come in, they're clean. You know how the men are about their tennis shoes, and they had on the white tennis shoes. And she, you know how she gets them off the bus, right? The very first experience, men who have experienced trauma and poverty and been in the criminal justice system. So they're being told to get off the bus and to stand in this line, and they're all wearing white tennis shoes, and you're going to be walking through mud and dirt. So the first experience with them was traumatic, okay? Because they're thinking about their shoes going to get dirty, and they haven't even gotten into it yet. So you see the men taking off their shoes and holding them. Okay, that was the first thing, okay?
Well, I think that's an important, one important contextual piece is just Ujamaa, we're referencing with Ujamaa Place. And, you know, one of the things that we have to do is that in community, we all know what Ujamaa Place is, and we have to explain it to all the folks who don't want to pay attention to us. So Ujamaa Place is an organization who that provides holistic transformation for young African-American men experiencing inequity at the intersection of race and poverty. That comes from their mission.
Thank you for bringing that into context, these experiential trips. So this was part of the civil rights research experience comes out of Ujamaanomics, which is a critical cultural financial literacy program that the men have to take while they're going through the theory of transformation programming. After the Middle Passage experience, the healing that takes place there, the men were bawling, crying so hard because they were finally able to let go of all of that trauma that they had built up in them. They felt they were at a place where they felt that they could show their real feelings. And I mean, they wailed and bawled for a long time. And so, Anthony, I thank you for introducing me to that because you've inspired me to expand that knowledge and to start bringing the men on that trip to witness that through them. And then when we finished that trip and went to Tuskegee and went to all the other places, when we landed in Minneapolis, we immediately, the very next morning, went to Duluth to honor the victims of the Duluth lynching. And so it was really a full experience, which we turned into a film. I released that film on Juneteenth. That's the way we get it out in the community. And that's how we educate. Because we are not going to force people to believe something that they don't want to believe. We're telling the story of our history, and we're putting out the truth through cultural content. And that's my contribution to the movement. If I can keep telling these stories and keep putting out this information, and it educates people, then that's my contribution to the movement.
You don't get healing in therapy sessions by avoiding truth. You actually have to face the truth and get through it in order to gain health. And that's all we're asking for, is to tell that true story. And so I thank you for being here with us. Ms. Monique Linder is the CEO.
I'm the founder and CEO of OMG Media.
So this is a person who walks the walk and talks the talk. We always end with our guiding quote, the North Star that guides us to continue our work. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Ms. Georgia.
In the words of Dr. Joy Lewis, may the revolution be healing.
This is Bearing Witness.
This has been Bearing Witness with Anthony in Georgia, a part of the Racial Reckoning Project, The Arc of Justice, a journalism project created and supported by AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, KMLJ Radio, and the Minnesota Humanities Center, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Programming on this station is supported in part by Minnesota Department of Health.
Hi, my name is Angela Barnes, Operations Manager at Arts House Center for the African Diaspora. I was skeptical at first about getting the vaccine, like many people. It seemed too fast, but I don't know. I just didn't know what I was going to do. But after doing my own research, I decided it was safe to get. Research for yourself. Find a credible website or websites, then make the decision for yourself. Since getting the vaccine, I've been able to reconnect with friends and family that I haven't seen in almost a year. It's been great being able to hug people again and just generally be around people that you haven't seen. So, if you're still feeling leery, check it out. Do your research. But please, get your vaccine as soon as you can.
COVID vaccines are safe and effective. More information about the COVID vaccines, including how to find a vaccination site near you, is online at vaccineconnector.mn.gov.
Making contact.
Anti-Asian violence and hate has increased since the start of the pandemic last year. Stop Asian Hate became a viral hashtag, much like Black Lives Matter, in the wake of Black people killed by police officers. The relationship between Black and Asian Americans is complicated. However, the groups are united in their efforts to call out white supremacy as the source of the violence against both groups. Solidarity between the Asian and Black community is common. Take Grace Lee Boggs, an Asian American woman who spent the better part of the last century in Detroit advocating for human rights for Black people. As we celebrate what would have been her 106th birthday on June 27th, we look at her life as documented in the film American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. Born in 1915 in Rhode Island, Boggs fought for social justice until she passed in 2015 at 100 years old. Boggs describes her early organizing work in Chicago.
And then I went out into the world and I found that even department stores would say, we don't hire Orientals. So I got on a train and went to Chicago, found a job there in the philosophy library for $10 a week. It wasn't very much to live on. So I found a woman who said I could stay in her basement rent free. The only trouble was that I had to face a barricade of rats in order to get to the basement. So one day, I came across a meeting of people protesting rat-infested housing. That brought me in contact with the Black community for the first time. And I want you to think about this now. I had never been in contact with Black people before. In 1941, the Depression had ended for white workers, but not for Black workers. I was aware that people were suffering, but it was more a statistical thing. And here in Chicago, I was coming into contact with it as a human thing. Being in contact with the Black community brought me in contact with the 1941 March on Washington movement to demand jobs for Blacks in defense plants. Tens of thousands of Blacks were ready to march on Washington, and Roosevelt couldn't afford that to happen, so he issued Executive Order 8802 banning discrimination in defense plants. I found out that if you mobilize a mass action, you can change the world. And I thought to myself, boy, if a movement can achieve that, that's what I want to do with my life.
In the early 1960s, Grace Lee Boggs moved away from the Marxist framework to focus on revolution she saw emerging right here in the U.S. from within the Black community. She began speaking out publicly in support of the Black Power movement and quickly became a force to be reckoned with. Networking with other civil rights activists across the nation, fighting against racist policies, and gaining a reputation with the FBI. Even Angela Davis, the 1960s Black Power icon, described Grace Lee Boggs as, quote, having made more contributions to the Black struggle than most Black people have, end quote. This speaks volumes about Grace Lee Boggs, the daughter of Chinese immigrants who went on to make a tremendous impact within the Black community.
The Negro Revolt is here. I believe that the Negro Revolt represents the beginning of a new revolutionary epoch.
I made a speech at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara. I tried to help these male intellectuals, these liberal intellectuals, understand that the Black movement was about something deeper than rights.
One could say, for the American Negro to achieve the middle-class white American standards is a revolution.
I don't think whites understand the degree to which Negroes do not want their whiteness. I'm trying to suggest that the Negro is striving to become equal to a particular image of himself that he has achieved, that he is not trying to become equal to whites.
There was a great philosophic transition for me, which I had begun when I began examining the difference between Martin Luther King and Malcolm.
The goal of Dr. Martin Luther King is to get Negroes to forgive the people who have brutalized them for 400 years by lulling them to sleep and making them forgetting what those whites have done to them.
There's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and nonviolent resistance.
My relationship to King has changed over the years. I was one of the organizers of the 1963 march down Woodward Avenue in Detroit.
I have a dream this afternoon. One day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house anywhere that their money will carry them.
But I didn't think much of him. I really thought he was naive. I really did, because I was a Malcolm person. I would go and hear Malcolm speak.
Why, you're the one that make it hard for yourself. The white man believes you when you go to him with that old sweet talk, because you've been sweet talking him ever since he brought you here.
And audiences would squirm as he would challenge them to think differently, to transform themselves. We see the events of 1963 through the eyes of the mass media.
Thank God Almighty,
we see events like that and are not aware of the struggles that were taking place and forcing new developments. Martin Luther King was being persecuted by the FBI during that period as being pro-communist. Many people in the Black movement were afraid that if they didn't purge themselves of left-wing elements, that the movement would be destroyed.
Here's historian Stephen Ward discussing Grace and her husband, Jimmy Boggs' perspective on radical and militant action as a strategy of the civil rights movement.
I think they felt that violence was already happening and that violence was inevitable. In fact, it was at the Grassroots Leadership Conference where Malcolm X delivered one of his most famous speeches, Message to the Grassroots.
Can we play the record?
Would you like to play it?
Yes. Okay.
We want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us, concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution.
Yes, sir.
Revolution is in Africa. Revolution is in Asia.
rearing its head in Latin America. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro revolution.
Forgive me, Grace. They've been thinking about revolution for a decade and a half. So now they're seeing in this particular radical and militant stream of black protests a new way to think about and envision and enact an American revolution. So when Grace helps to build the Freedom Now Party, she's the only non-black person in this self-consciously all-black political organization whose goal is not to achieve integration, but to try to realize some power, political power for African Americans.
The word power strikes white people as something dangerous, threatening. And we were only talking about blacks being in office.
That was Grace Lee Boggs. And again, you're listening to American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. Here's the film's producer and director, Grace Lee.
Back in 1963, Grace was still speaking as an outsider.
I want to make very clear that I do not claim in any sense of the word to be a Negro. I have not lived all my life as a Negro, and I don't think anyone who hasn't really can speak for the Negro.
But once she becomes a black power activist, she starts using the word we.
In the black movement, when we were demanding first-class citizenship, we were saying we were being denied that. We were very ethical, but we wanted more than that.
Right.
We wanted to become part of the people who took responsibility for the country.
So by 1966, 67, she's well known, particularly in Detroit circles, but also nationally, as a black power figure.
And I became so active in the black power movement that FBI records of that time say that I was probably Afro-Chinese.
You're listening to American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs, on Making Contact. To hear this entire program and others, check out our website, radioproject.org, subscribe to our podcast, sign up for Making Contact updates, take our survey, or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Now back to the film, American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs.
In 2008, Grace invited me to a tiny island off the coast of Maine.
That's Grace Lee, producer and director of American Revolutionary, describing an experience with Miss Boggs that brought her closer to understanding the rich and multifaceted life that the social activist led.
So if you will be on that side of me as we go across,
okay.
I feel more comfortable. Okay.
She and Jimmy began coming here every year after the turbulent summer of 1967.
Get more rickety by the day.
I hope that coming here would help me understand how she went from being the 60s militant to the woman I know today.
As we sat here against the background of the ocean, of the trees, we just began talking and we started these conversations, which are now published as Conversations in Maine.
Every summer, Grace and Jimmy would join their old friends Lyman and Freddie Payne in Lyman's family home. They had known each other since the 1940s when they worked with C.L.R. James.
Over the years, we had these long conversations.
The question of revolution and rebellion was a big question. You had long lived for the days when the mass would be in motion. Now the question is, where is the motion going? What are the depths of it?
And what changes have to take place in people in order to bring about a revolution?
There's too many of us.
Talking together, we were able to create a kind of consciousness among ourselves. And I think we realized a rebellion is an outburst of anger. But it's not revolution. Revolution is evolution towards something much grander in terms of what it means to be a human being.
You can have discussion, you can have a meal, you can plot whatever. We plotted picket lines, we plotted anything we wished to do. At the end, it was always, okay, let's put on some music and let's relax. And music, relaxing, and dancing, part of the thing. So then, tradition has it. Welcome to the house.
What pretty dedication.
Mm.
Shake.
Delicious.
Yeah. Well, I started going in 78 and then went back every year with Grace and Jim.
I think it's really important to understand.
It was my first exposure to talking about what's this all mean, where are we headed.
Ideas matter. And when you take a position, you should try and examine what its implications are. That it is not enough to say, this is what I think, this is what I feel, and leave it at that. I can remember, for example, do you mind if I just change my tape for a moment?
Grace has stacks of these old recordings, physical proof of how much she values conversation.
The only models that whites had.
We're the only living things that have conversations as far as we know. When you have a conversation, you never know what's going to come out of your mouth or out of somebody else's mouth.
Grace, come on.
Freddie, I'm sorry. I don't think this is... I really don't.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It all goes back to Hegel. For Grace, conversation is where you try to honestly confront the limits of your own ideas in order to come to a new understanding.
Talk is cheap, but you can talk about their feelings, about what was important about their feelings, and then turn around and say that
Nancy,
to the mother.
I really, really, really get... I'm sorry. When you just say talk is cheap like that, I can't. I find it very, very difficult to take. I want to tell you honestly, their talk was not cheap.
You're making an end. You're saying that
you're
this
saying
is
things like talk is
and
cheap.
This is, no, you're uh-uh. You're not listening to me. You're saying that we can talk about what's important in a revolutionary movement, but we don't have to act like it.
Grace was hard on people. There's no question about it.
Grace, I think what Nancy's raising is...
You know, I sometimes think she didn't mean it personally, but she would be so intent on whatever her idea was and be so sure that she needed to push you in that, and if you resisted, she'd get mad.
I think it's hypocritical.
I'm sorry, this you know, I feel the number of adjectives that you're using with regard to her are very excessive. I really do.
Well,
and I think you really should look at
well,
it.
Well, I should.
Did she make people cry?
Oh, God, yeah, she made all kinds of people cry. Myself included, but all kinds of people, yeah. I could probably give you a rather long list.
Two, three.
Freddie in the afternoon would make cranberry sauce, and I would read to her.
Jackson understood that the psychic scars carried by white workers were as damaging to our national well-being as the scars carried by African Americans. The hidden injuries of class.
There are times when expanding our imaginations is what is required. The radical movement has overemphasized the role of activism and underestimated the role of reflection.
Grace Lee Boggs was passionate yet practical. She was able to develop empowering micro-level community programs in response to oppressive macro-level societal problems. She represents the beauty of fighting for human rights in the face of adversity, while also creating a life of joy and love. By shining a light on Grace Lee Boggs' work in Detroit, the film American Revolutionary reminds us to never underestimate the power of local, place-based community building.
I grew to love Detroit and to feel responsible for Detroit that I was able to grow. And trying one thing after another and trying to learn from everything that I try. Mm-hmm. That's the only way. I mean, the illusion that there's a quick answer leads to burnout.
As Grace struggled to understand the violence that was devastating her community, she returned to the evolving ideas of Malcolm and Martin.
Malcolm really struggled and towards the end of his life began to be critical of black nationalism and went down to make common cause with King. After Malcolm was killed,
I would attend these meetings and I would see young people, 14, 15, 16 year olds, getting up and limiting Malcolm to sort of meet violence with violence. And I knew something was terribly wrong.
Why is nonviolence such an important, not just a tactic, not just a strategy, but an important philosophy? Because it respects the capacity of human beings to grow. Yes. It gives them the opportunity to grow their souls. And we owe that to each other. And I, it'll take me a long time to learn that. All of you who are clapping, I suggest you do some more thinking.
Our Father, we come now. We pray that you look on these down people this evening.
But as I saw the violence increase in our cities, I wondered, would it have been possible to combine Malcolm's militancy with King's nonviolence? I began reading King much more carefully. In 1965, the explosion in Watts burst out. And King flew to California. And he was amazed to hear that these young people had never heard of him, that they thought nonviolence was foolish. And he began thinking, what do I do about that?
I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society.
King said, what our young people in our dying cities need are direct action programs which enable them to transform themselves and their institutions at the same time.
Right now, bright sunshine at 66 degrees downtown, sunny at 65.
It's an incredible city. That's one of the things that's very exciting about Detroit also, because it's not going to be reindustrialized.
Mm-hmm.
It's got something else has got to come out of it. And we're really thinking about how do we rebuild it now? How do we take the space? How do we make something new out of it?
In 1992, Jimmy and Grace helped launch a program called Detroit Summer to transform the vacant lots and buildings of Detroit, hoping that in the process, young people would transform themselves.
Thank you for coming back, Daryl.
When they can see themselves making a difference, they also become different. That has to be part, an integral part of the process of revolution.
I have one line. Grace gave it to me Friday morning. Yes, and part of our organizing work, we want to bring the neighbor back to the hood.
How you doing? So I was 16, and I volunteered to be a part of Detroit Summer. I was actually the very first person to sign up.
And I had profound questions. Why does everybody talk about Detroit in the past tense? You know, it's just a sty. I'm living in Detroit now. And I don't want to feel inferior all the time because Detroit isn't the city that it used to be.
Grace Lee Boggs was a complex woman. She knew the ins and outs of political activism, community building, philosophical theories, you name it. Her brilliance was matched by that of her husband, Jimmy Boggs, a Black auto worker and political activist. Together, they made a strong and inseparable team, lifting up the voices of Detroit's marginalized populations. But as an individual, in her own right, Grace Lee Boggs represented another population that was also overlooked and underrepresented, Asian Americans. It was not until late in life, when she was asked to write an autobiography, that she really began to reflect on her role as a social justice advocate and embodiment of Asian American activism.
People began asking me to speak on the Asian American movement.
and I discovered my ignorance. People were so searching for icons that they sort of fixed on me, even though I wasn't an Asian American icon. The varieties of Asian Americans that I see around here is so enormous. I mean, it's just incredible.
I met Grace when I was still struggling with a sense of, you know, where do Asians fit in a world that's mostly white and black? When we think about Grace in the 20th century, she is very much an outsider. In the 21st century, she represents the uniting of people from different races and different backgrounds in a way that is now defining America.
Let me make a challenge to you, okay? With people of color becoming the new American majority in many parts of the country, how are we going to create a new vision for this country? Absolutely. A vision of a new kind of human being, which is what is demanded at this moment. I can't begin to tell you the number of young people who come to Detroit. They come in order to be part of this new world that is being created.
How many of you have been to Detroit before? You're going to see a lot of abandonment, but you'll see it's about rebuilding a new way of life for people who've been completely left behind by a capitalist system which has gone elsewhere looking for profit. People had to find new ways to promote economic survival when unemployment was reaching upwards of 50% as it has now. Grace was at the forefront of the movements in Detroit that were developing urban gardens and eventually even bigger urban farms.
Most gardeners, I say 90% of gardeners, don't garden on land they own. They're gardening on vacant lots that are next to their house or across the street.
And they paint it with the tires. To think of gardens as the basis of hope was something that was unthinkable just a few years ago.
As Detroit summer was emerging and they were doing murals and they were doing gardens, the question I was always asking was, what does this have to do with the movement? They're nice projects. I think what I've begun to understand is that individuals who experience and get involved in those projects become leaders, become thinkers, become compassionate people that see themselves as makers of history.
It starts with imagining the kids in the space and in the community and how it's going to grow more by trial and error than it's going to grow by blueprint.
That's always my downfall. I think I can get it perfect and then do it, as opposed to knowing that you do it by making mistakes.
Yeah, you make your path by walking.
Summer, it's more than a season. When I moved to the city, was the core of the reason. Can I clarify all the distortion you seeing? Gotta break your mind out of prison while the warden is sleeping.
One of my favorite quotes by Grace is that creativity is the key to human liberation.
You begin to shape the idea of what you mean by quality education, you know, and so
people, first of all, everybody who talks about quality education is really talking about how can our people become more like white people and advance in the system.
I don't, you know, I beg to differ with you on that.
Most people think of ideas as fixed. Ideas have their power because they're not fixed. That once they become fixed, they're already dead.
Grace Lee Boggs could not be put into a box or easily defined. She broke barriers to dedicate her life to uplifting disenfranchised communities. She represents perseverance, power, and her legacy lives on through the social movements of today and the countless young activists she inspired. You've been listening to the documentary, American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. Special thanks to the producer and director, Grace Lee, for use of the film. And Raptivist Invincible, for use of the song Detroit Summer.
Just as the truth prevails, set sail. Held the sellers by the rum runners, thinking and boozing ale. Underground Railroad, last stop, Detroit River. Escaping the freedom, had to swim across the winter. Can you feel the ancestors in these currents? To swim upstream, it takes vision and endurance. Look at the horizon, sun reflecting off the water surface. Detroit is better made, dog, so I'm sipping on some burners.
City, wonder how we made it through the winter.
For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/soul2021 to listen to the archive show. You can also snag a limited edition soul and hip-hop t-shirt before July 7th to show your support for the music and programming you love. Again, you can catch the Soul and Hip-Hop Marathon and snag a limited edition t-shirt at kboo.fm/soul2021.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival Upriver 2021.